we have to be very, very careful. What we're talking is not so much democracy, we're talking organised hypocrisy. Hard facts.
If there is one anniversary that no one in their right mind will be celebrating this week, it is the sixth anniversary of the start of the conflict in Syria. On March 15th, 2011, amid the turmoil that had engulfed the Middle East on the back of the so-called Arab Spring, an eruption of civil unrest broke out in the southern Syrian city of Dara. The proximate cause of the unrest was the detention and mistreatment of a group of schoolboys by the country's security services after they daubed anti-government graffiti on the walls of their school. Did the Syrian people have legitimate grievances with their government in 2011? Yes, undoubtedly they did. The introduction of neoliberal reforms around 2006 coincided with a severe drought that lasted 4 years, decimating the country's rural economy. This natural disaster, combined with the cutting of vital fuel and food subsidies in service to these neoliberal reforms, acted as a trigger for rural flight to the cities, which had the effect of pushing up prices and fomenting economic hardship. Add to the mix the global economic crisis, how it increased the prices of imports, particularly food imports, and you had yourself a perfect storm. But there's a marked difference between reform and ruin, and events in Syria in 2011 cannot be divorced from the wider context of the previously mentioned Arab Spring. Here, what began as a spontaneous mass movement driven by the righteous objective of ending years of political repression, dictatorship and injustice was turned by dint of Western intervention, starting in Libya, into a counter-revolutionary movement in which we saw NATO member states providing, however unwittingly or wittingly, air support for Al-Qaeda and other Salafi jihadist groups. The Middle East is a region scarred by the dislocating impact of a century of Western colonialism and imperialism, responsible for retarding its natural, social, political and economic development. The centrifugal forces of religious extremism and sectarianism have ebbed and flowed throughout the last century, engaged in a struggle, sometimes open, sometimes hidden, with the forces of modernity, secularism and non-sectarianism. This, in sum, describes the nature and stakes involved in the six-year-long, unremitting conflict that has been raging in Syria at gigantic human cost. Up to 400,000 people have been killed, many in the most brutal and heinous ways imaginable. Around half the country's population is displaced, and the explosion of the most genocidal ideology the world has seen since the Khmer Rouge were rampaging across Cambodia in the 1970s has turned the clock back almost to the 7th century. What had begun as civil unrest in Syria quickly morphed into an invasion by thousands of religious fanatics and extremists as they set about unleashing a mass experiment in human despair. The only thing that stood in their way and has stood in their way is the Syrian Arab Army, a monument to the non-sectarian, multi-religious and multicultural character of a society whose minorities can trace their existence in Syria back over a millennia and more, and whose existence has been under threat over these past 6 years. Without the adamantine courage and tenacity of the Syrian Army, made up of soldiers from every sector of the country's multi-religious society, combined with that of its Iranian and Lebanese and Russian allies, today in 2017, Syria would be no more. Ultimately, given the medieval barbarism unleashed in the country, this conflict should not have lasted 2 years, never mind six and counting. The fact that it has constitutes a withering indictment of Western foreign policy. I'm John White, and this is Hard Facts. Well, Dr. Marcus Papadopoulos is the editor of the magazine Politics First. He is an author and he is a geopolitical analyst with a special expertise when it comes to the Middle East. Marcus, welcome back to Hard Facts.
Hello, John, and thank you very much for inviting me back onto your show to talk about what is, unfortunately, a terribly, terribly sad subject.
Indeed it is. Indeed it is. Now, let's start with the obvious, Marcus. Syria is a sovereign state. It is a UN member state, and therefore its territorial integrity is every bit as inviolable as that of the United States, Britain, France, Turkey, in sum, all the countries that have been engaged in the willful violation of Syria's territorial integrity over the last 6 years. Now, I am one of those, I have to admit to a mea culpa here, who had placed hope in Donald Trump's presidency. During his election campaign, he talked regularly about fomenting positive ties with Moscow, about cooperating with Russia in the common struggle against terrorism, about joining those who are fighting ISIS or Daesh in particular, rather than working to facilitate the growth of Daesh by trying to fight those who are fighting Daesh, i.e. the Syrian government and its allies. I have to say now, it's clear that Donald Trump does not represent a departure from the status quo, and indeed, if anything, he represents the status quo times 10. He's recently announced the deployment of hundreds of American troops to Syria, and in response, the Syrian President Bashar al-Assad has described such a deployment as an intrusion of Syria's sovereignty and those who will be deploying those troops as invaders, and he is quite right to do so. Now, you are one of the few, and you're too modest to admit this yourself or to pronounce this yourself, who had been sounding warnings throughout the US electoral campaign with regard to Donald Trump. What is it you saw in Trump that the rest of us did not? And how did you come to the conclusion very early on that there would be no change in US foreign policy if and when he entered the White House?
Well, can I first of all establish this and reiterate what you said just now, that Syria's independence, sovereignty and territorial integrity has been violated by the West and its regional allies, Turkey, Saudi Arabia and Qatar, is an indisputable fact. And of course, the West has a long precedent of violating countries' independence and sovereignty and territorial integrity. We can talk about the former Yugoslavia, we can talk about Iraq, we can talk about Libya, and so on and so on. Now, in regard to Donald Trump, what I said before the presidential campaign started and during the presidential campaign was that, first of all, and most importantly, whoever sits in the White House ultimately will not be able to change American foreign policy, because American foreign policy is entrenched, and American foreign policy is all about safeguarding and strengthening American global hegemony. The American system is, as I said, is simply entrenched. And the only way you will be able to change it is through radical changes, through, let's use the word, a revolution. And let's all be level-headed. A revolution in America, like a revolution in Britain, is never going to happen. So first and foremost, all that matters in America when it comes to foreign policy is the system, and the system is entrenched there. Now, in regard to Mr. Trump, the issues I had with him was that firstly, someone was running for president of the United States, a country which is the most powerful in the world overall, politically, economically, and militarily. And yet Mr. Trump had never before held elected office. Now, to me, that is bizarre. That is bewildering.
Well, let's emphasize this point, Marcus, because it's hugely important, I think. This man never even held as much as a post on a town council. Not one, no, zero, zero prior political experience. You're right.
Absolutely. And I think that says a lot about the American system.
Yes.
And I'm very critical of Britain's political system, electoral system. But let's be clear, that would never happen in Britain. No one would be able to run for Prime Minister of the United Kingdom without holding elected office at the time. That would not happen. So we should pay credit where credit is due when it comes to Britain. But yes, Mr. Trump never held elected office before. But what does that say about the American political and electoral systems? It shows that, putting it in a colloquial way, money talks. Mr. Trump has always been a part of the American establishment, not the political establishment, but the economic establishment, which is just as important. The other points about Mr. Trump that I was highlighting last year was that he's a very ignorant man. He's made it very clear before and publicly that he doesn't read books. He has no interest in history, which is remarkable. Because in my opinion, anyone entering politics needs to have a sound knowledge and understanding of history. But he's made it very clear he doesn't have any time for history. And he's also made it very clear he gets his information from the television. Now, that to me made the alarm bells ring in my mind.
Yeah.
And also, someone who is a populist, they will say anything to get people's votes. They will promise the world just to get people's votes. And that is what he was doing. Now, his comments about Russia, yes, on the face of it, I welcomed them. He did say now and again that he wanted a better relationship with Russia. And when it came to Islamic extremism, he wanted to tackle that. Well, that's all very well. But then that takes me back to the point I made just now. Even if Mr. Trump was genuine, and you notice I'm using the past tense now because I don't believe he was genuine, and I think it's been proved that he wasn't genuine. But even if he was genuine about wanting to improve relations in Russia, the American system would simply not allow that to happen.
This is important, because I was going to come on to that. Plain the devil's advocate. We have to admit that there has been an inordinate effort placed by the Washington establishment, media and elements of the deep state to place Trump's presidency under a veritable siege since he took office. Now, I recall a few weeks ago, Rex Tillerson, his Secretary of State, who has known to have warm relations with Russia. He's conducted a lot of business in Russia when he was in the oil business. He's believed to have quite convivial relations with Vladimir Putin himself. But when he met his Russian counterpart, Sergei Lavrov, in Vienna at the G20 meeting of foreign ministers, he did so with the demeanour of a criminal. You know, you could see he was very nervous. He was very worried, it seemed to me, to be too friendly towards his Russian counterpart because of the way that he knew he would be flayed in the media. Now, how much credence do you put to this aspect of Trump's policy since he's been in office towards Russia and towards the Middle East, i.e. that he's been placed under this kind of siege by the liberal establishment who are intent on destroying his presidency before he gets a chance? Certainly the anti-Russian propaganda, the anti-Russian hysteria has been off the scale of late. Anything to do with Russia has been attacked in the Western press, including Russian media. Anybody who betrays or evinces even the slightest intention or sentiment towards fomenting any kind of positive relations or dialogue or discourse with Russia is attacked. So do you not place a lot of credence in that aspect, or do you see, as you say, Trump as just being a rank opportunist who went with the flow?
I stand by my assertion that he is, to use your expression, an opportunist. I think it is absolutely true that when a politician in Britain or in America enters government, the machines of the British government or the American government come around that person and they tell that person that this is the policy and this is how we will continue with it. This is how we will use it to achieve this and that objective. If I can go back to the 2010 general election in Britain, prior to that, William Hague, who was Shadow Foreign Secretary, was one of the arch opponents of the European Union. I mean, he wanted Britain to withdraw from the EU. So the Conservatives come to power at the 2010 general election, albeit in a coalition government with the Liberal Democrats, and William Hague becomes Foreign Secretary. Well, lo and behold, it doesn't take long for William Hague to become a very strong proponent of Britain's membership of the European Union, so much so that Conservative MPs started to refer, or Conservative MPs who were anti-EU, started to refer to Mr. Hague as, quote, the foreigner. So that just shows what happens, that the machines of government come round you. Yeah. And that has undoubtedly happened to President Trump and to other people in his government, that it's okay to say one thing when you're in business, like Rex Tillerson. It's another thing to say when you're running for the White House, as Mr. Trump was last year. But once you enter government, this is how we do things. So that undoubtedly has happened. That, and we can say the same undoubtedly happened to Barack Obama. Let's not forget, 2008, he was promising a new beginning for America on the international stage. He was pledging a change in foreign policy. He was pledging to reset relations with Russia. But do you know, John, I was a reporter on Tribune magazine at that time, and I was once again in the minority of people saying and writing articles that even if Barack Obama is genuine, he's not going to be able to change the American system. So, yes, Donald Trump is under, has been under a lot of pressure, but that is because he is the president of the United States, and that system comes around you like it did to Obama and like it does to other presidents. But I still hold true to that view that he is a populist, he is an opportunist, and he was even saying during the election campaign last year that Hillary Clinton should go to prison. Well, maybe she should. Yes. And I particularly loathe Hillary Clinton for what she did in Libya and for what she did in Syria. But let's hold Mr. Trump
to account
what he's been saying as president. Forget what he said last year. Let's hold him to what he's been saying as president. Regarding Hillary Clinton, he now says, as president, she's a good person.
Yes.
And Bill Clinton is a good person, and he may need them as a port of call during his presidency.
Marcus, hold that thought, because we're going to have to stop for a short break. Don't go anywhere. Join us after the short break. Hard Facts. Welcome back to the second half of Hard Facts. I'm sitting down with Dr. Marcus Papadopoulos, the editor of the magazine Politics First and geopolitical analyst. We're discussing Syria in the week of the sixth anniversary of the start of the conflict and crisis that has engulfed the country. Now, Marcus, we spoke in the first half about Donald Trump and about the role of the system and the fact that he's had to slot into the role of the CEO, essentially, of an empire, a global empire, and obviously the disjuncture between the rhetoric that got him elected and his actions since he's come into office. Now, I'd like to focus now on events in Syria itself. Now, I mentioned briefly about the announcement that hundreds of more US troops are going to be deployed to Syria, which is a violation of Syria's sovereignty and territorial integrity. Those troops have been described as President Bashar al-Assad as invaders, along with the other troops. Now, I'm concerned about this development because I wrote back, I think it was October, the focus for the Americans, I foresee, is Raqqa. Now, they're embroiled in the ongoing battle to liberate Mosul from Daesh across Syria's eastern border in Iraq. That's a battle and that's an operation that's gone on much longer than they had envisaged. But they've said from the start that Mosul is only part of a two-pronged operation, and the second part of that operation is to liberate Raqqa in conjunction with the SDF, the Syrian Democratic Forces, dominated by Syrian Kurds. Now, I'm going to put this to you, and I want to know if you would agree. I see Raqqa as key to their objective in Syria, which remains regime change in Damascus, because if they take Raqqa, they can announce this as an alternative capital from which the Syrian opposition forces can regroup and can demand the ouster of Bashar al-Assad, as the Syrian opposition has been doing throughout all the different rounds of peace talks. We just had the fourth round of peace talks in Geneva, which were inconclusive. That we had two rounds of peace talks in Astana that were held by Russia. The Syrian opposition, I believe, are refusing to come to Astana again for more peace talks in advance of the next round of peace talks in Geneva. They're playing hardball. They are preconditioned that Bashar al-Assad must step down before there can be transition, before the conflict can be resolved, I think is a non-starter. But do you agree with me that Americans have a malign agenda when it comes to Syria, given that they've yet to cooperate with Russia as they said they would, and this has been confirmed by Russia itself? They have yet to declare that regime change is off the table, as it was under the Obama administration. What's your thoughts on what's happening in Syria right now?
I totally concur with you, John, that America continues to have a malign influence in Syria. And there's so many things I want to say, and I'm very conscious that we're pressed for time. And as Napoleon said, time, give me more time. But I believe that it's actually Idlib is what we need to be possibly more focused on.
Okay.
Because I hear what you say about Raqqa, but it seems that it will be the SDF, led by Syrian Kurds, who will attempt to liberate that city. Now, it is true that the Americans are supporting the SDF, but so are the Russians. And let's also be clear that the SDF and the Syrian army are allies. And we have seen recently that the SDF has relinquished control of a number of villages which it was controlling to the Syrian army, and we should welcome that.
Now, just sorry, I'm just going to interject because, yes, you're right to say that. And the common threat that they have in this regard is Turkey, because the Turks have been invading Syrian territory, and this was a rejoinder to any moves by Turkey to take advantage and to use their animus towards the Kurds to take over Syrian towns and cities in the north of the country. Is that right?
Yes, I absolutely agree again. And the evidence is there. There is a Turkish expeditionary force in northern Syria. There was also one in northern Iraq, which is illegal. They never asked for the permission of the Syrian government to send troops across the Turkish-Syrian border. But I think that, the Turks recently have been saying that their forces in Syria and the forces which they are supporting, elements of the so-called Free Syrian Army, which is a mosaic of different Islamist groups, Ankara is saying that they want those groups to go towards Raqqa and liberate that. Well, that's not going to happen, because for that to occur, the Turkish forces and their Islamist allies would have to penetrate SDF-controlled territory and Syrian army-controlled territory. So forget that. That is just not going to happen. But I think that America understands that its objective of trying to overthrow President Assad and the Syrian government, the only legitimate leader and authority in Syria in accordance with international law, has failed. So the next plan is to try and maintain some sort of influence in Syria. And that influence is being carried out through Turkey, which is a staunch friend and ally to America. So I think we should be keeping more of an eye on Idlib, because certainly for the Turkish forces and their Islamist allies in Syria, that is a city which they could try and take from the Islamist groups which occupy it at the moment. And if Idlib was to fall under the control of the Turks, I think that would be a grave situation for Damascus, because it would only get it back through military force. And I think it's also important to say something else. We are in year six of the Syrian conflict. And yes, there were economic problems with the Syrian economy leading up to 2011.
As there were throughout the region, Marcus.
As there was throughout the region. Yeah. And yes, there is a lot of corruption in Syria. And Syrian friends and acquaintances of mine who are very supportive of the Syrian government, they acknowledge that. But it is also important to say this, that Syria has long had a problem with Islamism. And historically, Islamism in Syria has been led by the Muslim Brotherhood. It is now led by ISIS and Al-Qaeda. Yes. And we should also not forget that the current Islamist uprising in Syria is not the first. The first was from 1976
to 1982.
And, the initial protests in 2011, I'm not saying that all the people were violent. They weren't. But from the very first day, there was violence. Members of the military, members of the police were abducted. They were murdered and their bodies were mutilated. And, President Assad has said it on a number of times over the last few years that the Syrian government made mistakes in the first few days of the protests. But I just want to make it very clear that violence was there from day one. Not all the protesters were violent, but the minority of the peaceful protesters, they wanted change from within. They did not want to overthrow President Assad. They did not want Turkish interference or American interference. But the vast majority of them, they were Islamists. And the Muslim Brotherhood in Syria saw an opportunity, And they took it from day one. But ultimately, this bloodshed has been caused by the West, Turkey, Saudi Arabia and Qatar. There's no way hundreds of thousands of people would have died had there not have been outside interference.
Well, let me focus on this point for a little bit. The initial protests, there's documentary evidence, included all sectors of Syrian society calling for reform, with the lifting of the notorious 1964 security law, which had been in place in response to the centrifugal forces that you mentioned of Islamism in the country. And Alawites were part of those protests, Sunnis, Shia, and Druze. But then these protests moved towards slogans of Christians to Beirut and Alawites to the grave. They quickly took on a sectarian character. So you're absolutely right that the way that these this uprising or unrest developed was in a very dark and ugly direction. And this cannot be divorced from wider events in the region. The Arab Spring, as I said, had been morphed into an Arab winter in the context of the events in Libya, where NATO, under the UN Security Council Resolution 1973, unofficially brought an end to the Arab Spring as a progressive movement for social and political change and turned it into a counter-revolutionary movement at which Islamists were in the vanguard. Now, my point is this. Washington has known since the beginning of 2012 of the character of this uprising, of these events in Syria. Its own Defence Intelligence Agency, as we know, produced a document that surfaced about 2 years ago, which identified Salafi jihadists as constituting the dominant faction in the so-called opposition. That is the point. If Washington's foreign policy had been driven by any kind of moral rectitude and any understanding of the way that this could affect blowback, and it has, the victims in Paris, the victims in Brussels, the victims in San Bernardino have all suffered from this explosion of global terrorism that's emanated from the region on the back of this eruption of Salafi jihadism. The West is these governments are responsible for that. They have put their own citizens in danger. Because here's one thing about Bashar al-Assad. Whatever you might think of this man, he is an intelligent, rational human being. He embraces modernity. He presides over a government that can be negotiated with, a government that is not calling for indiscriminate terrorist attacks to be carried out on citizens in the West. He is not preparing such attacks. How is it that these Western governments could follow such an idiotic policy of trying to unseat this government at a time when they're faced with a threat of global terrorism that has been responsible not just for indiscriminate slaughter in the region, but in the West itself? And this is where we come to the moral sickness of regime change that in the second decade of the 21st century has Western capitals in its grip. Obama, David Cameron, Sarkozy, all these leaders, they have the blood of people in Syria and their own citizens on their hands. Don't you think so, Marcus?
Yes, I do. And we have to remember that America has a long history of supporting Islamist groups to achieve American geostrategic objectives. Islamists have long been a trump card of Washington, pun intended. If we go back to the 1980s.
Afghanistan, yes.
The Mujahideen were supported, were armed, were trained by the Americans.
Calling them freedom fighters. Sorry, they were calling them freedom fighters and depicting them as Jeffersonian Democrats, weren't they?
They were, and including a certain Osama bin Laden. Yeah. We can then go to Bosnia from 92 to 95, where the Americans were facilitating the arrival of Mujahideen fighters from Afghanistan to Bosnia to fight against the Bosnian Serbs, because the Americans were supporting the Bosnian Muslims against the Bosnian Serbs. And the Mujahideen was one of their most formidable tools to deploy there. And of course, we saw it in Libya in 2011 when they were supporting Islamist groups against Colonel Gaddafi. And we're seeing it again in Syria. And the point that you made about President Assad is also true. President Assad is not just an intelligent and respectful and progressive man, but he's also the guardian of multicultural Syria.
Yes.
And that is indisputable. And this nonsensical, idiotic line, which is put out by the West and its regional allies, that President Assad is anti-Sunni and he's instructing the Syrian army to carry out genocide against the Sunnis, doesn't make any sense. And I'll tell you why it doesn't make any sense. Because President Assad's wife is Sunni and he has children with her.
Yes.
Most of the Syrian high command is Sunni. Most of the Syrian infantrymen are Sunni. So it doesn't make any sense that whatsoever. However, the West doesn't need to put out an intelligent argument. It just needs mainstream media to take it up and to deploy it and to get public opinion on its side, to demonize President Assad, so that they can, so that the American government and the British government can say to their respective audiences, this man is committing mass murder, this man is committing genocide, that's why we need to support the groups in Syria who we're supporting. But of course, you know, if you have half a brain, you will think, well, first of all, you know, if President Assad hates Sunnis so much, why did he ever marry one?
Indeed.
It's a lie. But this demonization process of leaders who do not or who pursue an independent foreign policy has a history. They did it to Slobodan Milosevic. And of course, they did it to Radovan Karadzic, the Bosnian Serb leader.
Marcus, we'll have to leave it there. We've just marked the sixth anniversary, the lamentable anniversary of the start of the conflict in Syria. Just let's hope we're not sitting here a year from now marking the seventh anniversary. Thank you to my guest, Marcus Papadopoulos. Most of all, thank you for listening. Until next time, remember, the only facts worth taking seriously are hard facts.